This is the event that made me, with me, Liz Taylor.
Hello. I've built my success out of planning events all over the world as head of the Taylor Lynn Corporation. But actually, I know that success is built out of a series of life events. Moments, meetings, interviews, glance across the room, failures, trials, tribulations, the whole kit and caboodle. So I wanted to find out how the events in your life contribute to your success. In this podcast, you're going to hear conversations with an eclectic and exciting mix of people who I'm privileged to have had as my guests. And with every interview, you will get an extra episode, an air extension. Not the one on your head, but the one where you take the lessons and elaborate on how you can apply it to your business, your career, or just life in general. My cup is always half full. I love people, so let's get cracking and have some fun. And so I am extremely excited. It's with a great sense of anticipation that I welcome today's guest, Eamon Holmes, OBE. A man who needs little introduction and who most definitely has still got it. Born in Belfast, Eamon's been a broadcaster since October 1980. So welcome, Eamon, and thank you so much for joining me today.
Liz, thank you very much for having me.
Now then, we know each other quite well, but you will recall that we met on hallowed ground, strategically placed at a lunch by Michael Edelson, MUFC director, who was actually responsible in 1995 for securing my event company the contracts for the club. I want you to tell us why it ended up being the most expensive lunch that you have ever had.
Because you got me married and did the event, and you did my 50th birthday party as well. So that's why. But Elizabeth, money gladly spent, because, I mean, the attention to detail, you're the queen of party events. So what would I have done without you?
Well, that remains to be seen. But I recall, actually, that you sat down and you said to me, what do you do? And I thought, here goes, first fatal mistake. And I said, I am an event planner. And you said, oh, I'm going to be 50 in November. And I thought, second foot in the grave there. And then you said that you were getting married. But of course, it wasn't until I'd had the interview, was it, with the She Who Must Be Obeyed, yeah, that I actually got the wedding. So that was the start of our relationship, which has nurtured for, how many years have you been married now? 10?
10 years, yeah. Yeah.
Good. And still together? Because I did promise Ruth that I would do her second wedding. I did promise
her that. Yeah. No, still together. Just about. Just like you and me. Still together. It's amazing to think that that's only 10 years when I think about it, because it feels as if you've always been in my life. So that's lovely. Not only from a, you know, a business relationship, but a personal relationship as well. And you know, it would be, I mean, there must be other occasions coming up where hopefully we can work together again in the future.
Yeah, it's, well, Ruth and I have got the same birthday, so we're obviously very, very compatible. And you've been a great support to me and an ambassador for me over the years. So, yeah, we're good mates. I've got quite a few questions I wanted to ask you, and I wrote them all down, but I want to know a little bit about you. I know that you come from Belfast, and I know that you've got four brothers, but go on, give us a little insight into little Eamon.
Well, little Eamon was born 3rd of December 1959 at the Mater Hospital in Belfast. And Belfast is a very small city, really. You can basically carve it up into four areas, north, south, east and west. And yet it's a complex city because, you know, whichever part of town you're from determines your religion. It determines your job, your prospects in later life and how you've done. But it is the most, it's the biggest thing that I think I'm thankful for in my life, that I was born in Belfast, and that the one thing I can be sure of in life is that I can identify myself as a Belfast man. There's lots of things you're not sure of as to who you are or where you're going, but there's that intrinsic thing within you that you have in common with most people in Belfast, that I have in common with my brothers, that it's a language and a way of speaking and a way of understanding that I'm very relaxed with, very at ease with, and very proud to be from Belfast.
Do you have a Catholic upbringing? Were your parents strict?
Well, they were Catholic and they were quite moral. Yeah. They were, I mean, you know, I suppose as a youngster, you're ruled by fear of doing things wrong. And my mother and father had a very strong moral code. So between them and between going to all male schools, you have this intrinsic fear of sex and love and relationships, all of which are converge on being filthy. So you're not, you know, you don't have the healthiest relationship, I think, with the opposite sex, because, you know, the only woman I really knew growing up was my mother and my school teachers, and that was it. So my life ever since has been an education with women.
You obviously overcame that very quickly, Eamon. In fact, this was going to come up later on, but I will never forget a couple of years ago when we did that lunch, and you'll remember it was for child bereavement, and it was at the Hilton Hotel in Manchester, and it was on the sofa with Gary Barlow, and we had 450 women, and we were all so hyped up because Gary Barlow was coming. And you walked in first, and it was like just bloody amazing. It was ridiculous. They were like bees to a honeypot. And I looked, but hang on, they've got the wrong guy here. They just, you've got that magnetism. You've got that.
Well, I was one of only two men in the room that day. That's all that was.
It's irrelevant. At least you were the one that they were drawn to. It was. And that's a magnetism that I'm going to come on to, because there's something else that I want to refer to. But what I want to know is what lured you into journalism? Just to understand a little bit about the journey that you took.
Well, to have grown up in a very fragmented city at a time when there was massive civil disturbance, my life was quite idyllic, quite simplistic until the age of 8 years of age. And then I realized that, you know, we had to move home. Things changed because what were termed the Troubles in Northern Ireland's history broke out in 1968. And then you were aware that people were different. People were either Catholic or Protestant, or they were Irish or British, or this in-between thing called Northern Irish people. So there were so many divisions, so much conflict, so many questions where you thought, why am I being victimized for this? Why am I being caught up in this? Why are people we know being hurt and murdered and killed because of these troubles? And therefore, I think I had this mission to explain, and to explain to the rest of the world, which is, we're not all like that. Why are we doing this? We had to understand ourselves and the politics that drove all of this. And also I was highly influenced by being deprived of a lot of my years, particularly my teenage years, and you had to stay indoors. You watched TV. TV was on a mission to explain this sort of thing. You could see the reporters on the street corners doing their job. There was a fascination with this. So all in all, I wanted to play with words, explain, do this sort of thing. I don't really know. I'm a great believer also. Well, it's a bit spooky, certainly in my case. I mean, I was in a very working class, ordinary family. We lived in rented accommodation and then a council house after that. And so there was no easy path for me into journalism or broadcast, but yet it happened and I wanted to do it from 10, 11 years of age. And sometimes I wonder, if you wish something hard enough, maybe it happens. Maybe there is a fate.
This is The Events That Made Me, with me, Liz Taylor, discovering how it's not what happens to you, but how you roll with it that counts.
Was the one event that made you, do you think, sort of go down that route, or was it just a series of life experiences? I just wondered whether there was one event that made you think, right, I am going to turn right here instead of turning left. This is the route that I'm going.
Yes, there was. I'm going to turn right as opposed to left, because at 18, when I finished my A-levels at St. Malachy's College in Belfast, and I wasn't from an academic household, I said to my mother, I wanted to be a journalist and I was going to go to journalism college. And she said, no, you're not. you're going out to get a job. You're going to go out and get a real job. You're going to go and get a good government job. And I need another wage coming into this house, because there was my dad and then there were five sons and my mum. And my mum was a housewife. You know, she ran the house. My dad was as a carpet fitter, went out and they earned the money. And basically, I suppose, looking back, how naive I was, naive or respectful of my parents, that I did what my mother told me. And I got a job, a number of jobs, but basically for 10 months or so, I worked as a trainee manager in Primark, or Premark, as we call it, the department store, the clothing shop. And it was tough. It was tough. Retail environment was very, very tough. The hours were incredibly long. And that was my moment of turning right instead of left, because I could have stayed there and probably had quite a decent career. But I thought to myself, I don't really enjoy this. This is respectable. It's very hard. It doesn't come easy to me. I want to be a journalist. And I reapplied for my journalism course. And after a few questions as to why I didn't take my place the year before, I became one of 20 students in that that class that year. And I ended up the top student that year. And I suppose I was so thankful to be given another chance that I was going to make sure I wasn't going to fail at that, because I didn't want to have to go back to the real world. And people in my journalism class, and this is a good point for anybody who has ambitions, don't hide your ambitions. And my journalism lecturer would go around the class and she would say, right, what do you want to do when you qualify from here? And someone would say, I want to write for the Irish Times. I want to write for the Belfast Telegraph. I want to write for the Guardian. I want to write for the Independent, whatever, whatever. That's what they would all say. And it got to me and she said, and what about you, Holmes? And I said, I want to be on TV. I want to be a TV reporter. And the class would laugh. They would laugh. And I would look and I'd say, what are these feckers laughing at? I couldn't really understand why they're laughing. Because I wanted to be a TV reporter and I studied TV. I suppose the point was, you shouldn't really have ambition. The idea was, why would you ever express ambition like that? But to me, it wasn't, it was just direction for me. It was the area of journalism that I wanted to do. Now, the point of this story is that a year later, the journalism lecturer phoned me and she said, you always said you wanted to work in TV, didn't you? And I said, yes, Mrs. Fitzpatrick, yeah. And she said, well, there are auditions being held at Ulster Television for farming reporters. Do you fancy that? And I said, but I don't know anything about farming, Mrs. Fitzpatrick. I'm city boy born and bred. And she said, rule number one of journalism, Eamon, find out. So I did find out. I did get the job against very stiff and more experienced competition. And I got it on the basis, I suppose, of style over substance, because I knew how to behave on TV, where lots of people think being a writer is enough, but it's not being enough. You've got to be able to act the part or look the part. And I got the job. And it was absolutely incredible, because that changed my life. That was my right or left moment. I could have listened to my mother. I did say to my mother, I just want to say this. I said to her, Mum, I'm leaving this department store job. And I am going back to journalism. What am I going to do for money coming into this house? She said. And I said to her, I will work morning, noon, and night. I will work in the bar. And I did that. And I would do the journalism course. I'd work in the bar every single night of the week, including weekends. And I give her housekeeping, whatever she had to do. And that's what I did. Other people would literally pee their grant up against the wall and go to the pub and get sloshed and whatever. But I, from a very young age, was very directionalized. And I thought, this is what I want to do. And to be given a chance to do this is an amazing thing.
That is basically the event that made you, isn't
you
it?
Could, that- you could say that. You could say it was the person who made me aware that the job was there. It was the person who gave me the job in the first place. It was the people then after that who at 21 years of age made me the youngest TV anchor there's ever been in the UK, Europe, maybe the world. I got my own hour-long show from the age of 21, and I'm hosting news and current affairs every night in Northern Ireland on a show called Good Evening Ulster. I have no idea how and why I was given it. I would say that you will never see someone at 21 years of age hosting a news program. And I don't mean just sitting, reading autocue and reading a bulletin. That's not what we did. We did much more than that. But I had this hunger. I had this fervor. And there is that thing, Liz, when someone says, if you work at something you love, you will never work a day in your life. And certainly that was the case with me. I mean, there was a war going on in Northern Ireland, and it had to be explained. And I suppose people like me at a young age were given more prominence than someone who maybe was doing the same job in Norwich or doing the same job in Aberdeen or wherever. So we came to the attention of the networks, I suppose, much earlier.
I love that Eamon's clarity of ambition is what led him into his career. Find out what happens when you express your ambition in my bonus air extension episode, now in your podcast feed. What's interesting actually is that I went from school to Marks and Spencer's. I did the management training scheme at M&S and I was in retail for 10 years. And when you say that you worked at Primark, I think it's really interesting because the one thing it brings out in you is communication skills. I think dealing with the public, which whatever avenue you take in life, your communication skills are first and foremost, I believe. And, you know, when I interview people, if I walk into the boardroom and they're sat there and they don't actually get up and look me in the eye and shake my hand, they've not got the job. They don't even have to say a word. And so those are the life skills that you learn from the experiences that you have. And it's interesting that, you know, both of us have gone down career paths where communication is essential to the success of what we do. And you are the best communicator. And I'm going to tell you something now, which you probably won't even remember, but when you were getting married and you'd chosen the Elvetham Hotel, which was near where you lived, we went down the first time, we had a look at it, and there was a member of staff, I think she was in the hallway, I can't even remember, but we went back a second time. And when we walked in, she was the same woman was there, and it must have been a month apart. And you turned around and you went, "Hello, Anne, how are you?" And I thought, this guy is really good.
I would disagree that about being really good. Maybe some people aren't really good at that, but that was my life. That was growing up in Belfast. That was being neighbourly and sociable. My father, who was the carpet fitter, he knew everybody from judges to bin men. You know, he knew everybody. And working in the bar at night, you that was where I honed any social skills, because I was young, I was shy, and yet over the counter, I'd be able to say, "That's Jim Brown there. Jim's a school teacher, and he's a primary school teacher, and you're cleaning the counter and you're pouring Jim his pint and you're talking to him about that day in school, and then you turn to someone else who's a motor mechanic and turn to someone else who works as a... I learned what a phlebotomist was, I remember, because a phlebotomist is somebody who takes blood, and I used to talk to a woman who was a phlebotomist. And so those social skills, you copy people around you. Certainly, they're harder if they're false. And in my business, in your business, Elizabeth, you will know people who are false, who will say all the right things but don't care about people, don't remember their names. But it's quite easy for me, because I do genuinely, I'm interested in people and I probably care about them. So that's just the working class element of me, I suppose.
No, I get that, Eamon. And, you know, I make it my business as well when I go into the hotels, because these people are hugely important to me. So I'm wearing two hats. One's a little bit selfish with a commercial, you know, head on. And the other is, as you say, because you like them. But you meet hundreds of people. You know, we're not talking about being behind a bar in Belfast. We're talking about, you know, a broadcaster all over the world, all over television, and you remember everybody's name. I have never been anywhere with you, and I'm going to let you now, only between you and I, share the place card gate. Do you remember?
Do you want me to talk about that?
Yeah. that was the best. That was the best. And the fact that we came out, the fact that I never hit you or you never killed me, but go on, share that story.
I hurt you again after that. The thing is, without taking away from you, Elizabeth, in any way, you are queen of the castle. You are superb at what you do. And I am a bit of a control freak. And I do tend to want to supervise my own life and whatever. And it was difficult handing my 50th birthday party over to you, which was a superb event, and it was themed around football, and I think it was your idea to hold it at Old Trafford, and we had some amazing things from the tables through to the menus, the way the staff were dressed, all that sort of thing. I kept saying to Liz, right, are you sure you've done this? Are you sure you've done that? She said, go away, leave me alone. I came up to Manchester on the Saturday. She said, take the Saturday off, or we came Friday night. And I said, no, but I should call around and make sure everything's okay. And she said, no, leave everything to me. Everything will be, I have a to-do list here. Everything is fine. And I was quite specific about table places and who should sit beside whom. And that's interesting at any event. I mean, will so-and-so get on with so-and-so? They don't know them. Would they be a good mix sitting together? Whatever. We had quite a lot of people, Liz. So there were some very important people there too. And a lot of my family, my general family from Ireland, you know, big family circle, whatever. And so you had people from media mixing with people from, insurance, mixing with people from Manchester United, whatever it happens to be. So I was very specific about who would sit where. And Liz is going, yes, don't worry, everything's fine, in the way that Liz does. And she runs around with a clipboard and whatever. And so I thought, trust to Ruth saying to me, look, Eamon, this is what this woman does. This is what she's paid for. She's handled amazing events. Just leave everything to her, which was very against all my instincts. So anyway, that evening, we turn up 7 o'clock or so at the evening. We have the drinks reception. People start wandering through. I look into the room, which Liz has arranged for me, and absolutely stunning. And one of the nicest things she did was the base of every table was a massive football cut in half. So the bottom of it was a soccer football, black and white. And then the table was perched on top of that. I hope I've described that well, Liz. So, and this visual effect, and the floor was a football pitch marked out, the dance floor, everything was just amazing.
And the tabletops, do you remember the tabletops? They were shirts. They were United shirts that said Eamon 50 on. It was great. Until...
And there is and I look around and I say to Liz, the place names, where are they, Liz? Where's the place names on each table? And she just looked at me and I thought, oh, she's winding me up. She's joking me here. Like, place names. Now, it wasn't that you forgot to bring them. You just forgot them, didn't you? There was just no place names.
Well, we'd never had them. I mean, we can continue this argument 10 years or 11 years later if you really want. But I recall that you got up. This is what happened. You got up to make a speech. And in the speech, you turned your head to refer to somebody who was meant to be sitting at a specific place. And that was when I think you realised that there were no place names. That's as I remember it. I only remember dying inside, losing a stone within 5 minutes. And you never sent them. You never sent them. But
what? How much am I paying you for place names? What have I got to send them for? I thought that's what you did.
In the meantime, you still let me do the wedding. So you did get over it. We've got Mungo Jerry on there, your favourite Mungo Jerry. It's the summertime.
Seated at a table, but no one knows where they're sitting. I still can't get this argument. You know what, Liz? Everybody left and thought they had a brilliant night. They had a brilliant night. And that is the main thing. And when I look back at it, we had very important people, we had stuffy people, and they all loved it. They all were really, really nice. And I look back on that night and I think, I wish I could live it again. It was, I couldn't afford to live it again, but it was, I wish I could live it again.
It was a beautiful day. So do I. I wish you could do it again.
Hello there, I'm Eamon Holmes. Listen to Liz Taylor as she asks me about the events that made me.
Eamon, in my business, I'm only as good as my last event. Yeah. So I'm always looking for something better to do for the next time. Yeah. Tell me, how do you stay as good as you do?
Well, as good as you do is staying in employment. I suppose that's what you mean, Liz. And I suppose, like you, people like me have got to stay relevant. And to stay relevant, you've got to study your market. You've got to know your market. You've got to know what the trends are. You've got to see the trends coming. And perhaps you've got to reinvent yourself. So, for instance, when I look back at my life, I got the top job in Northern Ireland when I was 21 years of age. and I was still doing it at 25. Now, I could have, say I had stayed in that job till I was, you know, for another 10 years. Say I'd have done that job for 15 years. I would only have been in my mid-30s and probably finished. People would be saying, but he's been doing this for 15 years, the same job, 6 o'clock every night, Ulster Television. So I took the decision to move to England when I was given the offer, because I suppose it's like being a footballer and playing for your local side and Manchester United coming in for you. Do you go? And I left a job where I was being paid more. I was being paid 25 grand a year in 1985 to go to the BBC for 19 grand a year in 1986. So you could look at that and say, why would you take a pay cut? But think, because I was going to a bigger area. So I was a big fish in a small pond, and now I was choosing to be a small fish in a big pond, but maybe with the potential to grow and grow, because it was a huge pond.
So you consciously made that decision. It wasn't just sort of an opportunity that came by and you took it. You had a plan then. You obviously had a journey mapped out for how you want. You see, I've always wanted to be the big fish in the little tank, which is why I've stayed in Manchester, albeit that I've been able to branch out and have worked all over the world. But I've probably not been as structured as you, and it's quite interesting that you had that plan.
The difference between my job and your job, Liz, is you just have to keep doing the job well. My job depends on people's opinion. So if an executive goes home that night and their children, their partner says, not him again, all they have to say are, don't like the tie he's wearing, or he annoys me, or whatever, that's you finished. There's nowhere else to go. You know, you are the biggest fish in the smallest pond. And if someone decides on a whim, nah, I've had enough of him, that is it, over. Whereas you will just be there on your results. So, you know, people just want, they don't care how long you've been doing it. As a matter of fact, the longer you've been doing it probably says more about you, that your reputation is good, because if you were no good, people wouldn't be booking you, still wouldn't be doing what you're doing. So I think that is the difference. And what I would say about my job is that getting on the conveyor belt is very, very tough, very hard. But staying on the conveyor belt is harder.
That's the same with everything, you know, working. Somebody once said to me, you never want to reach the top of anything because there's only one way that you can go and you get to the top. I must tell you a very funny story. I recently took a deposit from the father of the bride, and it's a fabulous wedding in Cheshire next year, marquee, magnificent home. And he's a real, he's the chairman of a huge company. And he phoned me up and he said to me, Liz, he said, I don't mind paying a deposit, he said, but he said, you know, spring chicken. He said, what if something happens to you? He said, and I've paid all this money. I said, you know what? I said, if I was in your shoes, I'd be more concerned if something happened to you, because if you'd spent the money, you couldn't enjoy it. It'd be a lot worse.
You raised something else that we would have in common in our jobs, and that is stress, pressure, deadlines. And I tend to perform probably better. Now, it is stressful. There's no doubt. A lot of people would like a quiet life. But actually, if I haven't got a deadline, if I haven't got pressure, if I, you know, don't want to beat the opposition, then the excitement goes for me. That makes me buzz. I'm presuming you're the same.
Yeah, totally. I mean, absolutely. I thrive on it. The more stress, you know, the more challenging the deadlines, I thrive.
It is keeping interested, keeping relevant. And I never understand, Liz, people who, you know, take what I do, and you'll say to people, young people, you say, right, so you want a job in television? They go, yeah. And you say, well, what do you want to be? There's a sort of silence. And they go, and I say, well, what is it you want to do? Do you want to be a camera operator? Do you want to be a sound engineer? Do you want to be a floor manager? Do you want to be a producer? Do you want to be a makeup artist? Do you want to be a presenter? And they just look at you and they go, yeah. We're like, which one? It never ceases to amaze me that some people just think, oh, I just want in that industry. Where within that industry are lots of different specialisms. And it was easier for me because I knew I wanted to be a broadcast journalist. So that was easy for me. And I would say this, don't hide your light under a bushel, because again, a lot of young people are frightened to say, I really want to be on screen. Because what will happen is they come in and they're a runner, or they're, you know, they get some job as a, you know, in the, as a graphic artist or whatever. And someone else who they came through the door with, or someone who came in the door after, gets the job as the presenter. And then they feel really hurt. And you would say to them, but did you tell anyone you wanted to be a presenter? And they go, no, because they're embarrassed. They think, well, that makes me sound really big-headed or whatever. But if you don't let your intentions be known, then why would anyone pick you as such? And it never ceases to amaze me, often, the lack of quality that gets through to be a presenter. And they're often things that keep me going. I mean, you know, people may love me or loathe me or whatever. But when I often look at television and I think, well, I think I'm rubbish. I think I've really messed up. I think I've haven't been very good doing this or whatever. Then I turn on the TV and I see someone else who's truly woefully awful. And the difference is they think they're brilliant. They think they're absolutely superb. And then that's what riles me. And I go, I know I'm awful, or I was awful, or I did that wrong. But actually, the difference is they don't even know that they're rubbish. So therefore, that keeps me going. I sort of think, well, if he or she's got a job, then I'm going to have a job for a while.
My mission is to help as many people as I can become successful. So please leave a review or a 5-star rating on your podcast platform.
Tell me, why did you move to Manchester? What brought you here?
Well, I moved to Manchester in October 1986, which was quite prophetic. I didn't say pathetic there, I said prophetic. Because as it turned out, Alex Ferguson moved from Aberdeen to Manchester same month, same year. And I moved there as a presenter for daytime television, which was opening up on the Oxford Road in Manchester with a program called Open Air, which was basically a 2-hour-long version of Points of View. And that ran Monday to Friday. And luckily, I was given a football program on a Friday night from the BBC called Sports Round Northwest, which I presented with Dennis Law, the footballer. And for someone like me to have been a Manchester United supporter, to have come to Manchester, first of all, in 1972 with my dad and my brothers, and to be literally lifted over the turnstiles, to then come back, be presenting with Dennis Law, the lawman. And and when it came to the end of the evening, they would say in the program, right, so that's it. Eamon, you live near Dennis, don't you? And I said, yeah. Would you leave Dennis home? And I'm thinking, would I leave Dennis home? So I became Dennis Law's taxi driver while I worked for the BBC. So, I mean, that was just incredible. To be there with one of your idols and to count him as a friend was a really lovely thing.
Were you always a Manchester United fan?
Yeah, you see, people think Ireland is either orange or green. Well, thankfully, it's mostly red, and Manchester United red at that. And, you know, you've got your Liverpool supporters, you've got your Arsenal supporters, whatever, but basically Ireland is Manchester United territory. And one of the big things, particularly in Northern Ireland, the reason for that is George Best. There we had a population so small, and yet one of the most amazing footballers the world has ever seen. And I suppose when I look back at my career, to be asked by George's family to officiate at his funeral was incredible, because he is the most famous person ever to be produced by Northern Ireland. And to be asked by his family to say, we don't want a religious ceremony, but we want someone to MC the whole day. What an honour. I just could never have believed that such an honour would have been bestowed on me. And it was a great day, but it was also a tragically sad day.
It's funny because my father was an eminent QC, and I never forget, I had a very privileged, if not very difficult, upbringing. And I'll never forget one day this white Rolls Royce driving into the drive in Hale where we lived, and in it was George Best. And my father was defending him for speeding. And I don't think I realised then just who this guy was. And then, of course, he had blinkers, didn't he? He had the nightclub, which I think I went to when I was 14 with my high-heeled shoes and my wig. And, you know, he was a real, I mean, he was Mr. Manchester, and he was he was hot. They don't make them like that anymore. No. Just tell me, Eamon, was your first wife from Manchester or from Ireland?
No, from Belfast. We were childhood sweethearts. She was my first girlfriend, first girl I ever kissed. I met her when I was 16. She was 15. And we got married, yeah.
And you've got three great kids who are all sort of paving their own way. And then you've got the lovely Jack, who's, in fact, Jack and the Beanstalk, I think, is probably quite apt because when I saw him last, he'd shot up to like 10 foot or something. So you've got, you're lucky. You're a lucky man. You've got lots of wonderful things around you. And I'm glad that you have the affiliation to Manchester because it's my city.
Oh, well, you say it's your city and it's certainly my second city. I mean, really, I don't live in London. I work in London. But, if I could live, I would live in Belfast or I would live in Manchester, and I've had the privilege to live in both those cities. And the idea, if I retired, I will either retire to Manchester or to Belfast. And Manchester may have the edge because that's where the football is. And that's just a wonderful association, to be connected to the club. And, as a football reporter early on, I was doing stuff and Alex Ferguson called me over and he said to me, "Oi," and I thought, "Oh, I'm in trouble here." And he called me over and he had a really good chat with me about the, as he perceived it, bias within BBC sports department. And he went through every producer and presenter who were affiliated to Liverpool in some way. And he went through all of this in my mind. And I'm thinking, where's this leading? And he said, "But not you, not you." He said, "You always, any chance you get, big up United," he said. "And that's great. Keep on preaching the red gospel," he said to me. And that was it. Him and I were, we're well connected ever since.
If I had my time again, I would have studied law. And my father was a judge and he'd been a barrister. Mm-hmm. And that's what I would have done. What would you change? What would you have done?
I know what inside I would like to have had some purpose, I suppose. I suppose when I look at this coronavirus crisis, I look at medics and I think I really do wish I had some palpable gift, something where I could see of lives, change lives, and feel useful. Part of me would say that, but most of me would say, no, I dreamt of being a broadcast journalist. I became a broadcast journalist. I became more than that. I did other things. I hosted, light entertainment programs and sports programs and all sorts of things and seen all sorts of things. And I have enjoyed most of it. I haven't enjoyed. I think the problem with journalism is that once you go outside your field, you don't have many friends there. But I suppose I'm a funny old hybrid in terms of what I can do and what I have been allowed to do throughout the years. But to have been there in the public eye for 40 years. And for people still to tolerate you by and large has been a lovely blessing. And how many of us, certainly when I was growing up in the 70s, to actually say you would know someone who's been on TV, you don't know anybody who knows anybody who's on TV. And that was an incredible privilege to be given that, to experience what it's like to be somewhere like Belfast, a population of 1.5 million people in the whole of Northern Ireland, to be their news anchor night after night, to come out the door for people to recognise you, thank you for what you're doing, to then move and live in Manchester for 6 years and be involved in all sorts of programmes there, to find a city that is so welcoming, so lovely, so close to my heart and has stayed so close to my heart ever since. And then, to go on to national broadcasting and still be there and still do it. Why would you change it? I don't think why should it be valued? Why should it? I don't do anything that's life-changing. But I suppose part of me would say, why didn't you do something useful? But part of me would say it's been a beautiful journey.
Eamon, you're a very, very popular guy, and I, more than anybody, knows why. You mentioned when you were just discussing that about tolerating, And so before we go, I want to know, what is the truth about Ruth?
The truth about Ruth? Or the lovely Ruth, as I call her, because everyone says, Ruth's lovely. So I just call her the lovely Ruth. That's it. The lovely Ruth is here. She is here, actually. What is the truth about Ruth?
That I'm lovely, gorgeous.
Lovely is the word.
Domestic goddess.
Did I not just use the word lovely? There you are, the lovely Ruth.
She sent me a rude message this morning saying, if you died or something, why haven't you responded to my WhatsApp?
Because we're having a girly night out. Anyway, that's a whole nother story. Listen, Eamon, thank you so much. Thanks a million for being my guest. And I love you lots. And I cannot wait till you're 70 because I've got 200 name cards printed out. Ready?
Ready to go.
Make sure you listen to Eamon's Air Extension episode to find out why you should never, as he put it, hide your light under a bushel when I talk about the impact of ambition. That's in your podcast feed now. My next guest has had a few events that made her. She's a familiar voice and a TV favourite.
It became a passion, not because I desperately wanted to be this famous actor. It's just that as a Mancunian, once you make a decision like that, you'd be so shown up if you turn around and you don't do it.
Hear Sally Lindsay talk about the events that made her on Wednesday, the 1st of July. If you enjoyed the events that made me, share it with a friend and please leave a 5-star rating on your podcast platform. I also have my very own fabulous new website at liz-taylor-consulting.co.uk. Thanks for listening and see you next time.